We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're back, we're dads on the air.
And welcome back to another episode of Dads on the Air. It's Tuesday the 5th of October 2010, a beautiful day in Sydney today, driving up to the studios. And the studios are abuzz with some news about next week, which I'll announce straight off the bat. In the studio with me this morning is Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Good morning, Phil York of Dads in Distress.
Oh, of course, that's who I am. And next week is a very exciting week.
Yes, it is. A huge event here in Dads on the Air.
It is. So it's our 10th anniversary, the longest community radio program in regards to men's health.
Absolutely. We've been here for 10 years.
And we will have a lineup. Absolutely out the
calm
studio
down,
doors.
Audience. Calm down. I feel a bit like the Colbert dude or something.
Outside the studio doors, they will be lined up, all the members that have contributed to this wonderful program over the last 10 years, and people like John Stapleton.
Yes, coming back from Bangkok, especially for the show.
Yep, so stay tuned for next week. Coming up this week, we have a presentation with Maggie Hamilton at the New South Wales Parliament House, done in June this year, and it's entitled What's Happening to Our Boys. It's emceed by Greg Donnelly, who is a member of the New South Wales Upper House, and appearing with Maggie is Dr. Rubenstein, who is the founder of Pathways to Manhood program. Also appearing is Julie Gale, who heads up Kids Free to Be Kids, and finally Melinda Tankard Rice, who has set up a wonderful organisation known as Collective Shout, which is addressing sexualisation of girls. So before that, though, we will get into the news. Ian, some news?
Yeah, well, a couple of things from last week. Saturday's Daily Telegraph, front page news, criminal decision is the headline. Gemma Jones has written, criminals with serious records who have been to jail could soon work in schools after a tribunal ruled a would-be music teacher was wrongly denied a job because of his extensive history of crime. In a stunning decision, the Human Rights Commission found the man whose offences were committed over 8 years and included possessing illegal drugs, break and enter, and resisting arrest, was discriminated against because of his criminal history. After the intervention from the commission, the man who served 8 months in jail will now be offered casual teaching in New South Wales schools for 12 months, and if he satisfies departmental administrative processes, he can be employed. What do you think of this, getting criminals into our schools? You know, what are criminals going to teach them? Teach them how to rob banks? Teach them how to sell drugs? Teach them how to be prostitutes? You know, wonderful, wonderful stuff.
Very scary stuff.
Human Rights Commission saying that criminals should have equal rights with honest, decent citizens.
Well, you know, part of me agrees, but part of me still is very concerned about just the administrative capabilities and people keeping an eye on these people.
Yeah. Well, if you've got to, you know, keep an eye on them, why should they be allowed in a classroom with our children? I think this is completely and utterly inappropriate. I mean, has society got to the point where basically everybody's got a criminal conviction, so, you know, if we can't let criminals, you know, become teachers, well, we're just not going to have any teachers anymore. I don't think that's the case.
No, true.
I'm sure it's not.
Yep.
Why lower the standards to that degree? To me, that just seems ridiculous. Human rights, I'm sorry, you can't put the rights of the criminals above the rights of children. That's just wrong.
And a story here from the Sydney Morning Herald, the Sunday Herald, 3rd of October, by Jim O'Rourke. Dads urged to swallow pride and ask for help. Men struggling to cope with the increasing demands of fatherhood are reluctant to ask for help or advice on raising children, state government figures show. Just 1 in 10 calls to the government-funded parent line comes from fathers. Community Service Minister Linda Burney is urging more dads to call the free counselling service operated by Catholic Care. Her comments are echoed by fathers' support groups, who are urging men to make use of every available assistance for the good of their children. I guess this story sort of reverberates what was on last week's program with Paul Pritchard and Richard Fletcher, and we're just wondering whether these services actually target dads well, whether they are man-friendly or men-friendly. You know, some services definitely are not geared up that way, and you know, help lots of mums, and you know, it's a great service, and ultimately that helps the children. But the question still gets put out there: is this service really designed for men? Is it?
Well, it's obviously
accommodating.
Not.
No, it's not.
It's not.
So, parent line, pull up your socks.
There you go. Well, here's a bit of a light-hearted one. Milkshake choice flavours personality. Picking a milkshake is not just about taste. It's also a straw poll of personalities. A McCrindle research survey has found the flavours we love can be a sign of how sociable, sensible, serious or relaxed we are. For example, chocoholics are more likely to be loyal. Strawberry drinkers tend to go with the flow, while caramel lovers enjoy indulging alone. Wonder how they managed to get the funding to make a study like that.
I don't know. I just think I might start having caramel.
Yeah.
See if my life changes.
Yes. See if your life changes. That's it, people. Change your milkshake flavour. That's the key to changing your life.
Yes, indeed. From the Sydney Morning Herald, Paul Bibby writes, victims of domestic violence win special workplace entitlements. This is a very interesting story. The first New South Wales employment agreement with special entitlements for domestic violence victims has cleared its final hurdle, but the organisation that developed the idea says the provisions did not go far enough. The new agreement for non-academic staff at the University of New South Wales, approved by a majority of staff, specifically recognises the profound impact of domestic violence on the working lives of victims. Under the deal, the university is obliged to offer victims a range of support, including special access to sick leave, compassionate leave, so that they can attend court, counselling or medical appointments. So, interesting stuff there. Yes, it's needed, as long as it's not gender-weighted.
Absolutely. Well, we've got one here. This is by Gemma Jones in Friday's Telegraph last week. Shocking abuse of disabled. Gemma Jones has written, abuse, mistreatment and a lack of services for disabled children and adults have been uncovered by a state parliamentary committee. The Department of Ageing, Disability and Home Care was yesterday attacked by parents during the review of services the government provides. A submission by a former department worker revealed two assaults by care home staff in the 1990s. Parent Deb Robertson yesterday told the inquiry the department was negligent in the lack of help it had provided for her son Brett, who has an intellectual disability. As parents, if we treated our loved ones in the same manner, it would be abuse and we would be sent to jail, and rightly so, she said. Mother of two, Sadie Sackis, said she had resorted to videotaping her disabled three-year-old daughter's convulsions to convince department staff, who had accused her of exaggerating her daughter's disabilities. So that's all a bit. I mean, disabled children is horrible enough, but the fact that these people are having problems getting services, which are fully funded by the government, they're not gender-specific, you know, but these parents are complaining that the services are not coming through. A bit of a sad indictment once again, you know. Too many bureaucrats, not enough compassion.
Hear, hear. And that's it for the news. We'll be back after the break with the presentation from Maggie Hamilton and Co.
Sleight of hand and twist of fate. On a bed of nails, she makes me wait. And I wait without you. With or without you.
I won't give long introductions because time is precious, but I think most people have heard of Maggie or know Maggie. I think I first met about probably two and a bit years ago, and it's been a real great pleasure working with her on various matters over that period of time. Maggie has been in publishing for a long period of time, but perhaps in terms of being an author, that's what's really come to the fore now, and she's well known not just around Australia but internationally for her works. Her well-known books go back some time, What Men Don't Talk About, and What's Happening to Our Girls was, of course, the first book that captured my attention, I think the attention of many people in Australia, a couple of years ago when it first came out. And probably ever since the first day it hit the deck, people were saying, well, when Maggie is the companion book, What's Happening to Our Boys, coming out? And I know I, for one, was out there sort of knocking on her door saying, well, listen, this is very good. The issues you raise are very, very significant, but we need to turn our mind to the matters affecting boys as well. So that, of course, is What's Been Done, the project's complete. It's a wonderful book, and it's available now, and Maggie will give us an overview of that book and significantly the issues it raises and the matters I think that challenge us to think about. Dr. Rubenstein is the founder of Pathways to Manhood program. He's the CEO of Pathways Foundation Limited, 2002 to 2008, and he now runs the Rites of Passage programs in 8 venues around Australia for fathers and sons, as well as mothers and daughters. He is internationally recognised authority on the Rites of Passage program, and he's run lectures, in fact, all around the world, so we're very, very fortunate to have him here this morning. He was a GP for 12 years, specialising in adolescent health, preventative medicine and emergency medicine. In 2008, he was nominated for Australian of the Year, and in 2007, he was a finalist for the Australian Non-Profit CEO of the Year. So we're very, very fortunate to have the two speakers this morning with us. And as I said, we're lucky to have Julie and Melinda. Melinda's well known for her very, very great advocacy on matters to do with women's issues and increasingly in terms of matters to do with children and young people, particularly in the area of sexualisation of children. And Melinda has established, should I call it an organisation, a virtual organisation, I don't know what you want to call it, but it's called Collective Shout, but it's something which is really capturing the attention of many people, not just in this country, but internationally, in terms of a vehicle of dealing with the issues that we want in terms of promoting awareness and hopefully facilitating policy development and then ultimately, I think, regulatory change. And of course, Julie Gale, well known to us all, who established Kids Free to Be Kids, has done wonderful work for that organisation. It's been a great vehicle and very much a precursor, I suppose, to some extent with what Melinda's done in terms of showing what can be done by campaigning using, I guess, technology that's all readily available to us in terms of getting things like pornography removed from shelves in places like milk bars and petrol stations, etc. So thanks very much. That's enough from me, and we'll work through the four speakers progressively, and each one will just pass over to the next one. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everybody, for coming this morning. Thank you for the members particularly, because I know that you have so many calls on your time, and we appreciate your attention. And, Greg, we really honour and value your support, because it means so much. Because we're all just private individuals doing this. Thank you, Greg. You've been so courageous, and we have to speak out, because our kids, that's what being adults is all about, surely, is to speak out for our kids. Well, I have to say it's a huge pleasure to talk about boys. Those of you who've known me from the What Men Don't Talk About days know that I have a very special place in my heart for men and boys. And I think it's because so often the things that are important to them and the things that often can diminish their lives tend to be invisible to the rest of us, because blokes, from little blokes to big blokes, is expected to be strong and endlessly resilient, but we're all human beings. And I think one of the things that really hit me when I got into the research for what's happening to our boys is that, you know, we do always tend to see girls as vulnerable. We too do tend to get that, even if we're not doing everything perhaps we should yet to help them there. But boys, we assume, can just get on with it. And I think one of the things that I feel is very concerning for our boys at the moment is that before the 21st century issues hit, there was a whole lot of stuff we still had not tackled for boys. You know, we're still growing up little boys with less nurture, less focus on their needs, assuming that from this high they can kind of cope. We're terribly worried that if we nurture them too much, somehow they're going to be all soft and not able to cope with life. But that is not what the psychological literature says. I think also there are some real issues around reading and being confident communicators. And we now know from the wonders of neuroscience, which I think all of us love to delve into, that, you know, boys' brains are different from girls, and that if they are not read to and if they're not given that opportunity to communicate from being very little, they're at a disadvantage, particularly when they go then straight into virtual worlds often, which really compromises the opportunity to read and communicate. And these are really, really essential life skills. And we only have to look at the profiles of all the young guys in juvenile detention to kind of see how that hits there. And then, of course, so we, and also the fact that we still are not giving boys a rich emotional life, opportunities to express that. It's all going on there. You know, this view that somehow little boys and men don't have emotions. They have the full spectrum. It's whether or not we allow it. And it's really, really important in today's world because our boys are growing up, as our girls are, in a very, very complex world that demands huge abilities in terms of emotional intelligence, whether it's relationships, the complexities of the workforce, etc. So this is no longer a luxury, and this is something our boys need. I think also what really hit me when I, as many of you know who've heard me talk on the girls, the insidious marketing to children from 6 months up, so that the product placement now begins at 6 months, and I won't go into that this morning because there's other issues I want to talk about, but believe me, it does, so that by the time a child is two, they have those branded figures in their heads. What really hit me when I went back to look at the marketing again for the boys' book is to look at a new form of marketing which is called cradle-to-grave marketing. Basically, what the poo bars and marketing out there have done is costed how much per brand they can get out of a kid if they manage to hook them in between 6 months and three. And they have basically costed that as $100,000 per child for their life. Those figures are a bit old, so it's probably more like $150,000 now. So this has given all the manufacturers of a whole range of things a whole new market to go for. And so what you perhaps notice if you look around is how kids are being marketed to from very little in adult brands, and particularly now, from now in, boys, because whether it's the big entertainment people like Disney or it's the fashion manufacturers or toiletries manufacturers, they realize suddenly this is the last demographic that they actually have not marketed to. And so for the last couple of years, they have really got their teeth stuck into our boys. And so you'll notice things like whether it's Ralph Lauren clothing brands or Billabong or Rip Curl, it's from kids this high. That is cradle-to-grave marketing. And so what we're now seeing with our boys is we are actually seeing from preschool a whole lot of anxieties around physical appearance, around clothing, and that is really starting to intensify during the tween years. Having done research on the boys only 4 years ago, I was really shocked to see the number of boys I spoke to ate up who were extremely concerned about their clothing. They would say to me things like, I cannot wear the same T-shirt to school in 1 week. It's social suicide. These are eight-year-olds. Really worried about body image. Do I have, you know, am I a hottie? Do I have the right look? And do I have a girlfriend? So I'm asking these little eight- and nine-year-olds, you know, what do you want a girlfriend for? And they would say to me very seriously and very earnestly, if I don't have a girlfriend, I'm seen as a loser. And I thought, great way to start relationships, to see partners as accessories. So the marketing to our boys is alive and well. How does this kick in then by the time we get to the teens? We are already seeing a spike in body issues and anxieties around feeling good about themselves. And so many boys said to me, they hate the summer coming up because they don't want to go to the beach and be in a situation where they might have to take their top off. Haven't we heard all this before? We've created this already with our girls. They talk about having to have the abs, the pecs. There's kind of two ways the boys who are worried about body image go. They go for the kind of pumped up look. They study the Brad Pitts, and all the other figures out there in movie land who've, you know, spend a fortune on personal trainers to look a certain way for certain movies. Or they go for that androgynous, anorexic look. And the number of high school teachers I spoke to across the country who said to me how concerned they were about the over-exercising that is happening in high schools around the country, where boys are in the gym all lunch hour and then they're out doing the 10K runs at night. And, you know, as we know with bigorexia, which is like anorexia, you know, even though these guys might be pumped up, when they look in the mirror, they still see themselves as not. And, you know, it is a psychological disorder. So I think that is something we are going to, I have absolutely no doubt about, we're going to start to see this really biting to a whole new level. One of the things that I love about boys, and would have loved to have had a son or even a brother in my life, is the wonderful physicality, that just that sheer amount of life energy and zest for living. And it's so sad, I think, the way we dampen this down from early on. And we have this attitude, whether it's in education, because, you know, there are so few men in teaching now, as we know, or whether it's in the community, that somehow boys are a bit of a nuisance. And really, if we could just grow them up quickly, that would be a fantastic thing. And, you know, we see young guys skateboarding in the community or doing whatever, and, you know, we're just furious at them doing these things. And we don't stop to think for a minute, you know, our boys are very physical. What are we doing in communities to enable them to express that physicality beyond, you know, being in a sports club of some sort? And, you know, when you think of Bondi Beach, that wonderful skate ramp, one of the things when talking to people around the country who are working with boys and getting it right, you know, things like skate ramps in local communities in the full view of everybody is an absolutely fantastic thing. Great way for the guys to let off energy, to have that risk-taking, to be honoured by, you know, passers-by of our age who are going, oh, my goodness, that was amazing, because, you know, we'd end up in emergency if we tried to do anything like that. And so, therefore, they are doing the risk-taking, but they're doing it right in front of us, and they're being honoured by the community. One community liaison person I spoke to in Coffs, they had two skate ramp situations, one right by where all the shops were, and they even started to get the kids in the local paper. He said it changed the whole dynamic of the community. People really started to get involved in what the kids were doing and really honouring them. Another one, the residents thought it just didn't quite fit with the image of the suburbs, so they put it out in a very lonesome spot. Within no time, a girl had been raped there. It was where the worst elements of the community gathered, and a lot of kids didn't even dare go there because it was so dangerous. So we need to hold our boys close and keep them in eye, but give them that space. And there's lots of good ways we can do this. But what I saw with my research is that all this zest for adventure is going into these very dark and violent video games. If we take Grand Theft Auto, which is the game that most boys from 7 or 8 up are playing, it is really shocking when you realise what that game's about. You progress through a world of organised crime. What does this mean? You get involved in prostitution, you steal cars, you get points for killing cops, for killing prostitutes, and so on. And you ask yourself, why are we giving boys these games to play? They said to me, they actually find it a real stress relief to come home after school and kill people. What we know from the international research is that this gives the boys script for violence. It also, and this is a very critical thing, I think, for those who are still puzzled as to why boys are taking knives to school, it starts that whole thing of boys seeing the world as a dangerous place. And if you see the world as a dangerous place, then obviously you feel you have to arm yourself. It's no great mystery, nor are car chases. Our guys are watching action movies with car chases in every other day. Why are we surprised they wrap themselves around power poles? It's no difficulty. I think what is really serious is the new levels of realism. Melinda, Julie and I and Deb were at a conference recently where we had three of the top professors worldwide looking at this area. And they were telling us that, you know, because they're always trying to enhance the games, what they've now got is people from the military who've worked in the medical side of things in battle zones like Iraq and elsewhere. And they've hired them so that when the kids, you know, manage to hit a killing zone on the body, because that's how you get points, that you have to hit the killing zones, and somebody's brains get blown out, that they can replicate the brain splatter to a whole new level of realism. So this is something I think we really have to look at. Another thing with boys that I think we underestimate, and I think we've all been guilty of this for men and boys, is the kind of narratives and jokes that we women tell. It's become very fashionable to slag men and boys, and, you know, either they're Homer Simpson stupid or they're dark and dangerous. This has a profound effect on the way boys see themselves. You know, growing up feeling they have to apologize, it's not helpful. One of the really big issues, I think, is the sexualized climate our boys are growing up, with billboards of semi-naked women all the time, with the MTV clips, with anything and everything they can see on the net, the celebrity behavior, you know, really from Paris Hilton on, and when she put the imagery of her having sex with a boyfriend on the net, that was one of the first kind of really raunchy celebrity kind of encounters you could experience on the net. And in a lot of ways, that's quite tame now. And then you add in to the mix some very sexually aggressive young girls around the place now who are just after the boys constantly, not just verbally, sending them literally dozens and dozens of risky out there texts and visuals. How is a young guy coming into his understanding of himself as a sexual being supposed to behave around all this? How do we protect that so that we keep all that wonderful nuanced ability that we have as human beings to relate very, very hard? And then, of course, you add in the pornography, which is just horrendous. The reason I wrote this book is because when the girls' book came out, from the first talk I gave to parents, and I've talked to tens of thousands, a Tasmanian mum came up to me, and clearly an intelligent woman, just tears streaming down her face, and she said, "I need to tell you about my son. He was 12 years old, and he'd recently told her that he'd had sex with a girl at school, and what had happened," this is according to him, "was 18 months before a girl had asked him to go into a classroom to help him do something, which he did. The door had shut, she'd whipped off her skirt, had a thong on underneath, had the boom box, and basically seduced him." Now, this mum was a very grounded woman. She said, "I am not excusing my son, Maggie." She said, "He should not have had sex with this girl." She said, "What breaks my heart from here on in is what his attitudes to women are going to be." Something had been broken there in terms of the nuances, the wonderful nuances being with others. Boys aren't naturally violent. Deborah, just quickly skipping to another quick topic and then I'm going to finish. Professor Deborah Prothero-Stith from Harvard University, who's looked a lot at violence in boys and violence generally, said, "We've got to remember when a boy, any child, experiences violence for the first time, they're incredibly sad. Because their humanity kicks in. They know instinctively that's not right. But living in the world they live in, they are constantly desensitized. Boys are incredibly tender, and that is something that I just found again and again. So what can we do? We need more education around the early developmental needs of boys, of reading, communication with parents. We need community-friendly areas for boys to let off steam. We need to invite the men back into the equation, all our good men, the hundreds of thousands of good men we have in our communities, in our nation, the people who are the gatekeepers and the role models, who are struggling because of our attitudes to them, and the incredible paranoia about pedophilia, which stops them actually helping our boys. We need to celebrate our boys. And I would love to see a massive drive for all those bright young men out there who would just make the most wonderful teachers. Because they are not only helpful to our boys in schools, they are helpful to provide a balance to our girls and to support our women teachers who are struggling, and for the good men in people's lives to support a lot of the single mums out there who are trying to be mum and dad. And we can't do that. So, what is happening to our boys? They need our attention and they need a lot more support and interest. Thank you.
I went to the answer. He is the perfect child. He breaks the rules, calls me a fool. And then he turns and smiles. She's my boy, and I'm his daddy. I love him forever, love him madly. Cause he's my boy, my pride and joy. Nothing can compare with holding his hand, running my fingers.
They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
Dad's in Distress, 1300 853 437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
It's my great pleasure now to introduce a dear friend and somebody I'm very proud of, Melinda Tankard-Rice. Melinda has set up, as Greg said, Collective Shout, which is out there working hard to redress the incredible sexualization of our girls and dealing with the huge amount of pornography we're seeing out there. Thank you for all your efforts and your great spirit, Melinda.
It's very generous of Maggie to invite Julie and I to say a few words as she also acknowledged us last night at her book launch, which I think demonstrates the kind of person that Maggie is. I'm actually here as part of the Maggie Hamilton fan club, I think, this morning. Great admirer of Maggie's work, and Maggie actually has a chapter in my book, Getting Real, Challenging the Sexualization of Girls, very significant chapter. One of the reasons I'm so delighted about the new book that Maggie has written is that everywhere I go, I'm asked, what can we do for boys? Most of my work is around women and girls, objectification of women, sexualization of girls in the media and popular culture. But increasingly, I'm asked, what about boys? What about boys? And I suppose it's been dawning on me that we can't have happy, healthy, resilient girls if we don't have good boys. We need to address what's happening, what's being done to boys that is giving them distorted and delusional attitudes about what girls are there for. Certainly, they're getting a perspective about women and girls that they are just there to service them, essentially as service stations for boys, as pleasure centres for boys. And boys and girls are getting ripped off by this very negative, degrading view of what each other is all about. So I was delighted that Maggie wrote this book because I think it fills a huge gap, a massive gap. There hasn't been enough work done to address the real needs of boys, and I've been telling everyone about the book for about a year. I'm delighted also that Maggie has agreed, possibly at a weak moment last night at her book launch, to contribute to another book I'm writing on another delightful topic, and that is pornography. I've got a new book that I'm co-authoring with Dr. Abigail Bray, who contributed to my last one as well, called Big Porn Inc., Outing the Harms of the Global Porn Industry. And I'm sure to make lots of new friends when I write that one. But Maggie's the first one that I've officially approached, and she's agreed to write about the harms that pornography is doing to boys. We're seeing rising rates of compulsive porn use in boys, addictive behaviours around pornography. I'm being contacted by 14-year-old boys who say, I'm addicted to pornography, what can I do? A lot of people don't want to talk about it. It is a horrible subject, but we have to talk about it because it is really distorting our boys' minds and their attitudes towards women and girls. Our boys and girls are growing up in a pornographic landscape, and there's no way they can escape it. The author, Robert Jensen, who wrote a book called Getting Off, I'm actually meeting him in Boston next week. I'm attending a conference with my colleague, Deborah Malcolm, who's also here today, called Stop Porn Culture. Robert Jensen describes walking down the street and just stopping and crying because he says, where can a man go? Where are the public spaces he can go that have not been colonised with pornography? And I suppose reading his book, I came to see it from a man's perspective, that where does he go? Where does he go that he doesn't have to avert his eyes from hypersexualised images? And this is one of the reasons that Collective Shout has started, Collective Shout for a World Free of Sexploitation. We're only about 4 months old, and Collective Shout really grew out of a comment that one of the contributors to Getting Real made to me. She said, this book is a collective shout against the pornification of culture. And I love the term collective shout so much. I said, that needs an organisation, that needs a new movement. So I started one, and we have a website, collectiveshout.org. I'd love you to visit. We've got 1,000 members within a few weeks. And what we're doing is naming and shaming and exposing advertisers, corporations and marketers who objectify women and sexualise girls to sell products and services. We think it's time to ramp up and to mobilise the concern that is out there into a strategic new movement to take these people on who think they can do whatever they like. With the support of Julie Gale and others, we have seen some wins, we've seen some victories recently, and I think that we need to let these companies know that the bodies of women and girls, and increasingly of boys, aren't there to be traded. They are not there as items of sexual commerce, essentially. So that's why we started Collective Shout, and we'd love you to sign up today. We've got forms up the back, sign-up forms, or you can go direct to the website. We've got cards that will direct you to the website, encouraging people to speak out. Also, we're in an election year, and we want to know what our members, what our senators, federally and at the state level, are going to do about this issue. So we're mobilising people to let our elected officials know that we're not going to vote for them if they don't address this toxic culture that some of us are struggling very hard to raise children in. If you're interested in this work, I have a blog. I'm writing on these subjects every day. In fact, I have a beautiful blog piece at the moment up there about Maggie Hamilton. It's an interview with Maggie and about her book and why she wrote the book, What's Happening to Our Boys. So I'd encourage you to visit my website, melindatankardreese.com, and also the Collective Shout website. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and we'd love you to be part of this whole new movement exposing the harms of sexualisation, objectification and pornification of our culture. Again, I want to thank Greg for all of his work in this area, and Maggie again for giving us the opportunity to say a few words. Love your work, Maggie, and please buy Maggie's books. It's fantastic. Thank you. And I would now like to introduce my good mate, Julie Gale, from Kids Free to Be Kids. Julie and I met, I don't know when it was exactly, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and we've been doing this work ever since. One of the great blessings and pleasure of the work that we do is that we get to work with some of the best women in the country, and Julie Gale is one of them. She's a comedian as well, so that helps, because God knows we need some laughs. So please make Julie feel welcome.
Thanks, Melinda, and thank you, Maggie, and thank you, Greg, and thank you, everyone, for being here. What to say? Well, Maggie and Melinda have wrapped it up all very well, always very eloquent. I just want to let you know a little bit about what I'm up to with Kids Free to Be Kids. What I've seen in the last 3.5 years is a definite shift from this issue of sexualisation being seen as a moral panic to that actually it's about the mental health and well-being of our kids. And I'm very happy that it's been seen as that now. And we can put to bed this idea that it's a moral panic. And we have now, of course, a huge and fast increasing groundswell of people who are actually wanting and willing to say no and to push back. And people are really stepping up. I'm constantly getting emails from people saying I've written to this company, I've spoken to this manager, and, actually helping to create change now. So it's not just a few of us out there banging away, it's actually a real collection of people and a groundswell, which is fantastic. What I really want to see from corporations, from the retailers, the advertisers, the marketers, is proactive action rather than reactive. There's still too much reactive action, so that it's taking us to point out the bleeding obvious for them to actually take action. And often it's with the help of the media that finally corporations will withdraw merchandise that's inappropriate, for example, or advertisers will withdraw a billboard. So we've got a little way to go before the corporate world actually proactively decides to act responsibly to what our kids are exposed to. I'm speaking at a federal police summit next week on child protection, And I think that points to the fact that this issue is now being seen in the light it should be, that it's child exploitation. The week after, I'm speaking in Sweden at the World Summit on Media for Children and Youth. So really, it's actually a global movement now. We had the recent UK Home Office report into sexualisation, and now, of course, with Maggie's book and others, spreading it not just from impact on girls, but impact on boys as well. You know, you can really start to feel that we're all starting to wake up, finally, that we need to act for our kids. The one thing I'll say is that the issue of porn in the public spaces is moving along. Been working hard for the last 18 months or so with Melinda. Greg has been magnificent bringing it up in Parliament, though he has been told that, you know, it's bizarre behaviour to talk about porn and what's actually being sold in front of kids at their eye level, and to actually name what they're seeing and viewing, and to call that bizarre is bizarre in itself. And it's a lot of courage to get up and speak about it the way it really is. So that's now sitting with the Attorney General's Department, the Compliance and Enforcement Working Party. By the way, my submission that I wrote, I always include a lot of images in my submissions and my letters to CEOs and the like, because I think they need to know what they're selling. That stopped with the Classification Board for some time. They couldn't pass it on because of the images. They couldn't pass it on to the Attorney General's Censorship Party because of the images, and they're the people that are making decisions about what's on our shelves. So it's totally ridiculous. However, at the recent SCAG meeting, we were told that they are looking at these issues. That's all we know at this point. So we wait with bated breath for the next SCAG to see what they are doing about the classification and display of porn that is displayed in front of our kids' faces. So the journey continues. I'd like to pass on now to Arne Rubenstein. And thank you very much for a few minutes of your time. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, everybody, for coming along and coming out on this rainy day. And Greg, I really appreciate you organising this, and Maggie for the work you've done, and everybody else who's involved in all sorts of different work. It's very interesting for me to sit in here today and to listen to this. I haven't managed to get a copy of Maggie's book yet, but I think there's a box back there, and so I'm really hoping to leave with one. But I had a very different experience in coming to very similar conclusions about the issues with boys. And for me, it revolved around my work as a general practitioner and working in emergency departments, where consistently I saw wonderful young boys. Despite everything that they're being exposed to, I still found that the kids under 10 in Australia are full of life and enthusiasm, and they love to wrestle, and they love jokes, and they'll look you straight in the eye, and they're an absolute pleasure to be with. And I would see those same boys as teenagers, or I'd see their older brothers, and it was a very different experience. And those boys would be coming in, and they'd typically have a hood pulled down over their face, and they wouldn't look you in the eye, and they'd grunt when they spoke to you, and I could see the trouble they were getting into. And in the emergency departments, I'd see the issues with drugs and car accidents, and it's like, you know, how can we be giving our kids so many opportunities and then things are going so wrong? And as a father of two teenage boys myself, I kind of feel like I'm playing Russian roulette. You know, I don't know, or I didn't know, whether my kids were going to be one of the ones who went totally off the rails and got into drugs and into trouble, or whether I was, you know, going to have kids who were able to navigate that time. Now, I would love to change society. I would love to put the marketing people on trial. I would love to change the education system. I'd love to change what's displayed on billboards and in newsagents and everything like that and the internet. But I don't think I'm really going to be able to at this stage, and I really take my hat off to the people who are trying to. But my work has been around looking at, where do I think that I can have maximal impact? What can we do if we accept that at this stage society is like it is? What can we do to support our boys, and where is it that I feel that I can have the greatest effect on what is happening? In my research, I found that there were two significant major issues that are really affecting our boys, and the first was the relationship with their fathers. And there was some research that came out in the Sydney Morning Herald a while ago telling us that the average father is getting 8 minutes a day with his sons. And I dealt with a lot of, I've worked in the from the prison system with all sorts of men who've been in all sorts of trouble, who've been in jail, who've killed people, who've done terrible things. And I look at these people and I think, wow, this is the worst man I've ever met in my life. And then I ask him about his story, and consistently they tell me about a disastrous upbringing where they had no father, or they were abused by their father, or they were beaten, or they were kicked out of home, or whatever. And there was a incredibly strong link between that relationship, and there's tons of research out there which shows that the quality of your relationship with your father massively impacts on you later on. And the other side of it is that if you're blessed enough to have a good relationship with your father, that really helps enormously. You know, and ask all of us to think about what sort of relationship we had with our own fathers and whether that was genuinely satisfactory, and also the relationship that we as fathers are having with our own children. The other big area that I found was massive for boys was around how we deal with the transition from boy to man, or how I should say we don't deal with the transition from boy to man, and that we have a whole generation of men that we're still not quite sure when we're supposed to feel like a man, and you know, when all of that kicks in, and that we actually have no formal process in our society that acknowledges and honours and supports that transition from boy to man. And once again, I ask all of you to think about when you were, and from girl to woman, by the way, and you know, all of what I talk about is as relevant for girls, but we're just focusing on the boys today. So if we think about ourselves and our own particular transition that happened around puberty, you know, was it an honouring, appropriate, communicative process, or was it something that was more around getting drunk or doing drugs or having sex or something like that? And I've for a long time had a concern there, and I started looking into rites of passage. That's a whole other story. But in a nutshell, what I found in my research was that all over the world, every Indigenous society and community had a rite of passage for their boys and their girls when they reached puberty. And the really interesting thing was that they all basically did the same things. There were these really common elements that they all used. And those elements condensed down was story, challenges, and a form of honouring. And we looked at it and we said, okay, can we create a program that involves fathers, and can we create a program that involves a rite of passage and do that with our boys? And so 15 years ago, we started this Pathways to Manhood program. And we built that up, and we a big aim was to also get it into the mainstream, to not only have it out in the, I don't know how you describe the non-mainstream, but very much to have you know, people from the cities as well as people in disadvantaged areas. And we had an enormously positive response to this program, to the point where it became a national organisation in 2000. And as Greg said at the beginning, I was CEO from 2000 to 2008. And we built it up to a point where we were running and are still running something like 40 programs a year in 8 different places around Australia, have over 1,000 people attending in a year. We have mother and daughter programs, we have junior programs, we have leadership training programs, and we have really struck a chord by having not only the process, but having the fathers and sons involved. So in reality, what it is and what we do, and there are many different ways that this can be done, but what we do is we take boys and their fathers and we take them out in the bush for 5 to 7 days, and they have to leave behind all their electronics and watches and mobile phones and reading material and pornography and anything like that. Stays at home, it's just a boy and his dad out in a tent for that time. And we use the elements that were common to the rites of passage of story, challenges and honouring. So the first thing is every day we sit in a circle. It's simple. Man, boy, man, boy, man, boy, with a fire in the middle. And the men tell stories. They talk about what it was like when they were a boy, the relationship they had with their fathers. Big story for a lot of men. They talk about women. They talk about their greatest failures and their greatest successes. They talk about death. And story has been shown to be the most positive teaching modality. Porn. It's come up a lot today. If we want to stop our kids using porn, we can put all the advertising we want on the TV. We can tell them everything we want in the classroom. That may help, but what will really help is when an older man gets up there and says, I watched porn between the ages of 14 and 20. It really did me no good. It really impacted on my relationships. It really gave me false expectations. I've been divorced twice. I'm still struggling to work out how to have a relationship with a woman. That's what the boys really listen to. They don't listen to you telling them how to live their lives. They want to hear our stories. They want to know what it was like for us. They want to be able to ask questions. The next incredibly important element is challenges. We talked about the skate parks. We create challenges on these programs. Do things like the boys spending time solo in the bush. If we don't create challenges for our boys, they will go and do it themselves. If they're not on skate parks, which is a good challenge, they'll be driving cars as fast as they can. They'll be trying drugs. We are losing boys because they are trying to initiate themselves and feel like men. And I believe that we as a group of men actually have a responsibility to be creating and observing and assisting these boys in going through these challenges. And the third incredibly important part of our program is this concept of honouring, which we heard about how powerful it was having the skate parks in front of the community. So we do a process where at the end of our camps, the boys, one at a time, sit in front of all their fathers and the men, and their father comes up to them and publicly honours his son and tells him everything he loves about him and everything that's wonderful. And then two other men from the camp will tell the boy also the gifts and talents that they see that that boy has. Now, when a boy is publicly honoured by his father in front of other men, that changes his life. It would be great if boys were told 1,000 times by their fathers that they love, that they're loved. That's not necessarily going to be happen, but at least they can be told once and really feel it, because there are generations of men who were never told that. And when they're also honoured by other men and that their passion and their talents are recognised and we say to them, this is who we want to be, we see you, we want you to be that person, that has a massive impact. Now, we conducted independent research into our programs and we found that there were significant long-lasting impacts, including improved father-son relationships, greater respect for women, and an increased desire to complete schooling. So the Pathways model, and I just have to correct one thing that Greg said, is that I no longer am the CEO. Pathways is running independently, and I don't run all those programs anymore. There are lots of other men who are running them. But for us, or for me, the challenge is how can we take this work and actually make it really widely available? And Pathways has been a fantastic test case. We've developed great programs. We know they have definite impact. There's an issue always around how to scale. And the concept of telling boys stories, creating challenges for them and honouring them can actually be done in many different ways. The taking them out in the bush is fantastic, but it can be done in the home, it can be done in the school. So what we're really looking at now is to tap into existing resources like the education system, sporting groups. You know, fantastic, I had a meeting with the West Australian AFL Commission. Why can't we get the boys who are playing in under 14s that once a week, two or three boys at the end of training are sat up there and the coaches and the other boys honour them for what they do on the sporting field and off the sporting field. Those sorts of things, bringing it into the education system, actually educating families around doing stuff. There are other broadly networked organisations around Australia. It's been demonstrated by international programs like the Rock and Water program, which originated in the Netherlands, that these things can in fact virally scale. So I guess I'd like to say, please watch this space. The concept of rites of passage is really strongly coming into our community. The knowledge that father-son relationships are hugely important. The issues around respect for women, of boys and young men, is very topical and very relevant. And it's fantastic that we have parliamentarians here and we have people who are involved in the field. For me, the more resources that we can put into these areas, that for me is what I've defined as the area where we can have the most impact. And so I'm very hopeful that it will in fact increase the support. I'm in fact heading off in 2 weeks' time to England, where I'm giving talks on this work, and also in Israel. And then in September and October, we're actually running rites of passage programs in both of those countries. So there's also a lot of international interest in this work. And I was fortunate enough to be one of the lead facilitators at the first international conference on rites of passage that was held in Hawaii 18 months ago. I guess I want to finish, and I always do this when I give a talk, to challenge all of us to say, the concept is great, what about doing it in our own lives? And to think about our own sons, our own daughters, the people who we work with, and if we can even leave here with a small commitment that in the next 24 hours we will do something with one of our children, or our partner, and we'll also find a space to actually honour them and just tell them something that we love about them or appreciate about them or something that they do well. So thank you very much for coming this morning, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to you all. Thank you.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
What I'd like to do now is open up for questions, which means that our guest speakers, if you're munching on your toast, might be interrupted. So I'd like to sort of throw it open. I don't expect the guest speakers to come up, but and I think probably the room's small enough for people to just ask the questions and people to respond. So happy to open the floor up for about 10 or 15 minutes. Okay, so we're talking about a greater than 50% divorce rate in Australia now, and there's also some research that comes up which says that one in three divorces that occur within 1 year, the father is basically having no contact with the son. So it's a massive, massive thing that we're talking about. And what we say is that, well, first of all, we try and get the father involved, but if we can't, that the boy must come, that we find other men to support that boy. And in fact, on some of our programs that we run, over 50% of the boys are attending now with men other than their own fathers. A grandfather, a stepfather, an uncle, a friend of the family. And that what's so important, the ideal is that they're actually getting honoured and seen by their father. But if they can't, that they still need to get seen by that sort of father energy. They need to get seen by men. Because if they're left out there in isolation, it creates anger and massive issues. So we really just need to do the most that we can. And I guess the other thing I'd say is that, once again, all of this doesn't just have to be in the bush. You know, in the schooling system where boys can get honoured by the male teachers and all those sorts of things, every level that we do that has an impact. And the whole thing around mentoring. I live in a small town in northern New South Wales, and my thing is that if I see the teenage kids in the street that I know, I feel I have a responsibility to go up and say hello to them, find out what they've been doing, and just have that connection. And it is a tragedy, as mentioned earlier, about the whole thing around paedophilia, where if a man pays attention to young boys, we look at him suspiciously, and we need to change that.
My children would say it was ancient history, or in ancient times, but in the 1970s I did postgraduate studies in the United States at the University of Virginia. That was in law, and one of the most brilliant students that was at Virginia at the time, and was I was fortunate enough to be in two seminar groups with, was a girl who was down from Massachusetts, from Smith, at doing law at the University of Virginia. Now, Smith, you may well know, is one of the great all-girls schools in the United States, and its graduates, in many respects, are absolutely sensational. I was wondering whether any of the panel might care to share with us what their present thoughts are about streaming of boys and girls in relation to primary, secondary, and indeed tertiary education. That this, when we talk about how we form boys and how we form girls and so on, one of the primary frameworks for that is our primary and secondary schools. Now, should we be having some particular perspective over that and what looks to be a better norm? I can't forget that in Australia, for instance, it is the practice of the upper classes, the professional classes and the upper middle classes to substantially stream their boys and girls. That's the way the very top of our society goes on. But for some reason or other, at middle and lower levels, we don't seem to be as adamant about the whole thing. Do any of our panellists have comment about that?
Look, I think we absolutely have to... different things are required to really nurture boys and girls. One of the questions that I get constantly asked is, you know, are kids who are at single-sex schools travelling better than those who are not? And sadly, the answer is no. I'm not saying that there isn't value in that, but we have a huge super parent that is sitting over everything we do now, and that is popular culture and the marketers. When I first started to interview the girls for the girls' book, I was really freaked out by the fact that kids, whether they were from really low socioeconomic areas or well-heeled areas with lots of resources, were giving me exactly the same answers. And anybody who knows doing research, that's not a good sign. It's a sign perhaps that your questions aren't right. And then it occurred to me, they're being super parented by popular culture. You know, if Britney burps, they all know. And so we've now got a new tier to deal with. But I still think within the education system, we need to, exactly as Anne has been saying, we need to be much more aware of what the needs of girls are and boys in relation to education for life as well as education for career. And I think that's where, you know, we understand why we had the push for education for Korea, and it was very valid. I think the problem is now we're turning out kids. We know they have collapsed life experiences. They're massively immature. We have the neuroscience for that. In a world that's 100 times more complex, and they just often don't have a lot of common sense. And I think we do need that education for life.
I won't give an opinion on whether the sort of the overall education should be streamed or combined, but what I would really like to see and what I believe we could easily do is, regardless of how, whether it is streamed or combined, that we could create a process where, as teenagers, boys and girls actually get to sit together in a space where it's done respectfully. And one of the things I know is that when we run our programs, we get all these boys, you know, arriving on the camps, and they're like normal kids. They're immature and they're running around and they've got all this stuff. But when you sit them around a fire and you have them men sitting between them and you get them in that sort of serious, respectful place and they speak, I am always amazed by the incredible depth and maturity and emotional intelligence with which they can express their deeper feelings. And I would love to see a scenario where we, as, you know, 13, 14, 15-year-olds get a group of girls and a group of boys actually sitting in a circle together and asking them how they feel about themselves, how they feel about the opposite sex. What they, you know, imagine if a group of boys could hear a group of girls saying what they actually really want out of a boy and vice versa, and we could engage those conversations. I think it would be actually a very simple process to set up, and if well done, would be very powerful. So that's my... You know, one of the things that we talked about in Pathways is in the future running camps where we have father-son camps here, a mountain in the middle, mother-daughter camps here, and towards the end, you actually bring the boys and the girls together, keep the mothers and the fathers apart, but bring the boys and girls together, and it would be incredibly powerful to do.
Thank you. My question is for you, Melinda. What's been the biggest success with Collective Shout?
I think the fact that it exists is pretty good. The fact that it came together in such an amazing way in such a short time. I mean, I have colleagues here, Deborah Malcolm, Tessa Rossington over there, and we've picked up some other great women along the way. And I think to have 1,000, you know, members in probably 3 months is not too bad, and a fully functioning website. A couple of the recent wins we've had, Best and Less put out a tween-age push-up bra for girls aged 6 to 12, creating the illusion of breasts for girls that don't actually have any. Why would you want to do that exactly? And I blogged on that. Collective Shout got active, and within 24 hours it was being removed from all over the country. Those kind of things make you feel that you have a voice. The other win that we've had a few. Another one that Julie helped to lead the charge on was Cotton On for Kids had toddlers' jumpsuits, and the little boy's jumpsuit had I'm a Tits Man, a jumpsuit for babies. So our children, our toddlers are not immune from this, these adultifying, sexualizing messages. So I understand as we speak that Cotton On is removing 480,000 items.
40,000.
Only 40,000, sorry. 40,000, that's good. That's pretty good anyway. 40,000, I failed math, so you know, it all doesn't mean anything to me, but 40,000 jumpsuits from around the country. We still have some issues with Cotton On though, don't we, Julie Gale? Cotton On is producing some pretty bad stuff at the moment. The other thing is, just another recent example, a football club, a boys' football club under 16 in the Gold Coast was being sponsored by Hooters restaurant chain. And this sponsorship deal involved Hooters girls as cheerleaders in busty uniforms, barracking for the boys, 15 and 16-year-old boys. And you can see in the photographs of these Hooters cheerleaders with the boys actually look pretty uncomfortable, really. And so what you're suggesting to boys is that this is part of the enjoyment of the game, is you get these, you know, semi-naked women gallivanting around and bouncing around at your game. And, you know, is embedding, really, Hooters in with this club. So blogged on that and put it on the Collective Shout website. And the AFL has forced Hooters to stop that deal. That deal has been stopped. They're just three recent ones off the top of my head. So I'd like to think that we get to a place where we want to make the corporations not want to hear from us. Like, we want them to think, if I do that, maybe there will be a backlash. You know, this is a consumer-led movement, empowering people. The other great success, I think, is that we hear from women who say, and from men as well, Before I might have been a little bit reluctant to make a complaint. I might have thought, maybe I'm prudish, maybe I'm hung up, maybe it's just me. But what people say to us now is, I go in there and I make a complaint. I say, I don't want that porn at my child's eye level next to the lollies when I have to pay for my petrol, and I'm not going to come to your petrol station anymore, I'm going to go somewhere else if you don't remove it. We've had people say, I go into my local video store and the porn titles are beside the kids section, and now I will make a complaint. I think that's probably the most profound thing for me, is to hear from so many people who say, I feel empowered now to take action. Before I thought it was just me. Now I know that actually I'm not part of a minority. So many other people feel the same way. So, thanks for that opportunity to pitch the organisation a little bit more. That's great. CollectiveShout.org. As I said, we will have some forms up the back. But, you know, we need to demonstrate that we're serious about this, because it is getting worse. If I could throw in another quick example, Nickelodeon, the children's media company, has produced the most extraordinary games. I'm really surprised, but this even surprised me. Nickelodeon, so popular with kids, has produced games including Perry the Sneak, which teaches boys how to stalk women and spy on them in the shower. This is a virtual game, and the aim is to be a peeping Tom. This is a game for little boys, primary school age boys, animated game. And another game they have is Naughty Classroom. And the wording for this game says, live out your fantasies for your teacher. And the whole aim is to throw the chalk on the ground in a certain way that the teacher will bend over. And it shows the children's eyes popping out as the teacher bends over. Naughty Classroom, thanks to Nickelodeon, the children's global media empire. So we've been involved in a campaign against that, which has been led by the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood in the US. But, a lot of parents have absolutely no idea what their kids are playing. So we want to empower them as well. I'm sorry, that was a bit of an indulgent answer there. So someone else might want to have a go now.
I was interested to hear your comments about challenges, because I think that's really important, because the kids will engage in some kind of activity, and whether or not they succeed, they're given some honouring for that engagement. And I was thinking about comments I'd heard from young people who were arguing that they no longer had to, or they didn't respect older people, because older people had to earn that respect. And I just wondered if do you see any kind of engagement there, that perhaps that process of getting kids engaged in particular kinds of challenges might actually have a positive effect, that they begin to understand what it is that older people might know. Or if you just had any general comments about that lack of respect, or that feeling that they didn't have to respect their elders.
Thank you. I think it's a massive problem that the engagement between the younger population and the older population has broken down. We have expressions in our society like, what would you know, old man? And it's actually interesting that you bring it up, because there's actually quite a large movement starting around elders, happening also within Australia and internationally. And what it's sort of moving towards is that there is a big responsibility for the elders to in fact be doing the rites of passage for the boys. And it actually has a double impact, where it benefits the boys in the ways that we're talking about, but it also gives the elders a place in society. And they have all this information that they can pass on, and they have all this knowledge, and they have all this experience, and we don't respect it. So we've got this whole generation of elders who are sort of wandering around, what's our role, et cetera, et cetera. But that if you actually connect up the elders and the young, and you do it in a respectful way, that it's a very powerful combination, and then it actually frees up the one in the middle, which is us, the parents, to do what we do. And in fact, there's an interesting... We find very powerful stuff when we get boys and grandfathers attending our programs. And there's a saying that boys and their grandfathers have a very strong bond because they have a common enemy. And in fact, if we can find a way that, in our experience, is you've just got to drop the kids out of all that cultural stuff that is they're being bombarded by. And that's why getting out in nature or somewhere just away from it. You don't even have to do it in nature. You can just... close the room and turn down the lights. But if you can take all that stimulus away and then actually get them feeling safe and respected, that they do have an enormous desire to be seen. We know that. But they also have an enormous desire to learn and to hear the stories of older men. We also know that. So it's actually about creating the right scenarios for that to happen. And our experience has been that when we do it well, that the impact is not only on the boys, it actually extends into the family, into the elders. You know, there's a very big knock-on effect, that, which is what we're really looking for. So I hope that answers your question.
Hi, my name's Kylie. I work in youth mental health services for Southeast Area Illawarra Health Service. And I work with young people who are at risk of developing psychosis, who have had their first episode of psychosis. There is a screening tool that we have to use in New South Wales Health for all women 16 and above to screen for domestic violence. And we do this as a mandatory course. And recently my colleagues and I were interested because we have an overrepresentation of young men in youth mental health services. And we thought, why don't we use this tool and screen our young boys between 14 and 24 young men? And surprise, surprise, every single one of them experiences some form of violence, family violence, interpersonal violence, humiliations. Every single young person, this is not a formal research, this is my therapy clinicians, psychiatrists, nurse colleagues. And I guess my question would be to Greg here is, I'm curious as to why it's not mandatory to screen our young men for issues of violence.
Well, there's a perfect key for me to take away from this morning. No, seriously, a matter that I can raise with the minister. Quite able to do so. At these sorts of fora and discussions, we often have people raise matters. And this, I guess, is the point of bringing people together who are working at the cutting edge, be it in terms of working with people or advocating on issues, and members of parliament, that we actually can hear directly from people. So I'm more than happy to take that up. I presume that no one perhaps has raised that point before and articulated and made the claim that that change be made in terms of policy or practice. So that's what would need to be done. I'm more than happy to raise that with Minister Burney.
Yeah.
Well, listen, on that note, perhaps, can I just wind up by thanking first and foremost our guest speakers this morning. I think... I think I sold myself short by saying just pay up an extra $30. I mean, for the quality of the speakers, I could have easily upped it to 100. But very seriously... In just over an hour, we have had four very, very good and very four powerful presentations. I can assure you of that. I've heard many people speak on these matters before, but the people today are of the highest calibre. And the fact that they haven't just passed but present into the future are being invited to go overseas and present on these issues at international fora just reflects the quality of the work that they are doing and the acknowledgement and the recognition they're receiving, not just here in Australia, but around the world. So just one more time, can we just thank very, very much the guests who've come along today.
Dads in Distress, meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And we're back. What a great presentation that was from Maggie and Dr. Rubenstein and just wonderful information.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that was great. Well, I actually took part in the in Maggie's survey that she did for that book about our boys, being the father of a boy. And Maggie, she's a wonderful person to talk to. She's so compassionate and so intelligent, and it's just great to have people like that working on these vital issues.
So when we see our kids next, let's honour them.
Absolutely, and also this idea, we don't have any notion of initiation in our society. We don't have, our rites of passage usually involve extreme drunkenness and stupidity more than anything, rather than honouring and nurturing and showing our children that the path to adulthood, to manhood, is an honourable path.
Indeed it is. Well, that's it for this week. If you'd like to listen to this program again, you can download it from www.dadsontheair.net. Have a great week. Stay safe. And
we'll be back with our 10th anniversary show next week. We've got John Stapleton coming back from Bangkok and all the old faces and characters.
Rock and Pop.
Yep, Rock and Pop, Peter Vandervoort. Lots of people, lots of the characters who've made this program the interesting, vital program that it's been for the last decade. And next week will be a celebration of all of the talent and all of the people who have contributed over the decade to make Dads on the Air the longest running men's issues radio program in the world.
Should be a great show.
We're Dads on the Air. We're here because we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're Dads on the Air.